This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Korerotia, here on Plains FM.
Well, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa, and welcome to the Human Rights Radio Show podcast Speak Up, Korerotia, which airs on Plains FM. I'm pleased to say this is the second show we've done in conjunction with COCA. Kai, thank you very much for organising this. COCA is Christchurch's Centre of Contemporary Art, for those of you who might be out of town. I did one last year on Antarctica, and this one's looking at art and social responsibility. Also using one of COCA's exhibitions as a jumping off point for a discussion. We've got Ruth Watson. It's her exhibition that we're going to be using as a starting point for this discussion, Geophagy, and she's going to be, I hope I pronounced that correctly, she's going to be anyway introducing us to her artwork and to the ideas behind it. We'll hear more about the exhibition and these ideas as we get going, but firstly, our panellists. Perhaps, Ruth, we'll start with you. If you could please introduce yourself and then the panellists in the room. So for those of you listening, we've got Ruth on Skype.
Yes, hi everyone. Thanks very much for coming out. It's a big deal on a, you know, Tuesday night, a week night, a school night. So I'm Ruth Watson. I'm an artist. I'm Skyping in from Auckland just because I'm a little bit kind of busy at the moment with another project. Otherwise, I would have loved to have come down.
Kia ora, I'm Jennifer. I'm COCA's gallery coordinator. I also wrote the exhibition text for this show, which was a very welcome dive back into academia for me. Delve through all the texts referenced in the show and pulled them all together. COCA's resident geophagy expert.
Oh, geophagy. Oops, sorry, I mispronounced it.
So it's a wee bit easier to just say geophagy. I think it sort of sounds a bit sort of meatier and tastier as well, too. I mean, probably both are okay, but I've been going with geophagy. So
I think probably the issues around pronunciation are kind of part of the question marks, I would imagine.
Hi, I'm Shannon. I'm a PhD student at the University of Canterbury. I'm studying literature. I'm here tonight in my capacity as a socialist feminist. So I'm going to be critiquing some of the sort of conversation around ethical consumption, personal responsibility. So that should be good. I hope not to be too negative.
Awesome. I'm Alice. I come from kind of like a practical kind of ground level sustainability, how do we stop messing up our world kind of lens. I run Saikuru here in Christchurch, which starts conversation around our clothing and the environment and around that. And I also have my own podcast/radio show on RDU where I get locals in and we talk about that kind of stuff as well. So yeah.
I think one of the things I'm looking forward to in this panel is the topics art and social responsibility, and we have an artist and an art curator, but also two people who don't count themselves as connected to the art world. So it'll be quite interesting getting, I think, an outsider's or outsiders' perspectives as well. We thought we might kick off the conversation talking a little bit about geophagy as an exhibition and the concepts behind it, what inspired it basically, and use those sorts of ideas to start the conversation.
Look, I'm sad to say the inspiration for the show was something rather disgusting, which is that when I was overseas, I got very sick, or me and a whole bunch of people got very sick of the terrible vomiting kind. And you don't need all the gory details about that, but the short version is I ended up taking some charcoal pills. I was in San Francisco and was getting some suggestions and doing things a little bit differently to how I might otherwise do them. And it occurred to me that charcoal pills, apart from it being like eating an art medium or something like that, it was all quite interesting, seemed like a very sort of middle-class form of eating the earth kind of thing, which we all sort of know is a thing out there in the world. We know that people eat dirt or clay and different kinds of soils, and that this activity is generally, usually kind of pathologized as a form of there's a thing called pica, which is, you know, that's when people, you know, they're eating light bulbs or, you know, bits of steel or chain or, you know, balloons and things like that. So geophagy gets considered a sort of subcategory of pica, but people are a little bit confused about it. Anyway, I was doing some collaborative writing with a poet in Wellington called Gregory Kahn, and I did a bit of reading around it, and I got quite interested in the non-pathological aspects and also maybe thinking of it as a kind of a, maybe as a metaphor for our kind of consumption of the earth and the resources that we're using up. And as I'm doing all this kind of reading and writing and thinking and recuperating, I could sort of see things. I could see all these mouths munching, and I started to want to make video work relating to the theme. And so the video work kind of came a little bit before the clothing in a way, except that around the same time, my interest in some of those things, you know, fast fashion, the microfibers, what's happening to the fish life, the Pacific garbage patch, all those kinds of things that we all know about. I'm sure everyone in the room knows about those things. All started to kind of converge, and I was looking for a way to bring them all together. What I did want, I knew that I wanted to do, was to make something that had a rather sort of slightly unpleasant effect, that when you were in the presence of all this stuff, that it gave you a sense of something being out of place or out of sync or kind of just generally wrong about its being in the world somehow. So I've tried to set that up both for you in Christchurch, and preceded by that in a sort of, you know, monomaniacal monster stack in its first iteration in Auckland. Kind of mini stacks, although they're fairly large mini. So that's where it kind of came from. And all those things were mixed in there. If we come back to issues about responsibility, or I'm very concerned with complicity or my own complicity in this kind of process, because whatever it is that I'm saying or talking about, I don't see myself as being separate from it. I don't see myself as pointing my finger at this is something that other people do, this is something that we all do. I'm wearing probably some of those kinds of clothes at the moment. I've got a lot of those kinds of clothes. I have had a lot of those kinds of clothes. I mean, not necessarily the exact specific ones, but, you know, of that type. That's very hard to escape in our daily life, all this kind of stuff that the world is producing, and what we do with it and where it goes is all something that we've all got to spend, you know, more time, you know, thinking and talking about and doing. So if it turns out that the artwork sort of prompts those kinds of discussions, then I think that's great. Although, as you now know, it wasn't inspired by the desire to illustrate that discussion. That came out of a very strange place, which was kind of being sick and eating some charcoal.
I might just quickly jump in for people who are listening and haven't seen the exhibition. At COCA, it takes the form of a bunch of stacks of 260-odd pallets all together, piled up with a bunch of secondhand clothing and six different monitors playing video and audio kind of stuffed into the stacks, hidden around them. So when you're walking around, you've got these stacks that are taller than you, covered in clothes, and it's a bit of a maze and it's really overwhelming. But also you've got this incessant audio coming from six different places, so you can't really make out what any of them are saying. And it's definitely got this huge feeling of just being overwhelming and not quite right.
Ruth, you mentioned you had some of those kinds of clothes, and Jen, you talked about the clothes. When we're talking about those kinds of clothing, and maybe this is a comment for you too, Alice, based on what you do, what do you mean, those kinds of clothes?
Yes. Well, I suppose I'm old enough to remember that it was rare that you went and bought your clothes. Mostly your mother made them for you, and then I was brought up to sew my own clothes. You'd buy your shoes. And then that kind of just seemed to change. That just seemed to sort of like turn just about overnight or something at some point. And now it's the other way around, where making your clothes is kind of, you know, the rarity. And then the fabrics that it's made of. So when I said some kind of clothes, I mostly meant a lot of non-natural fibres, things that give off microfibres that, you know, come off in your washing machine, then go out into the ocean, things like that. And certainly just a high turnover of things that get bought. And, you know, you might think that you're doing a good thing giving them to the op shop, but as we're all starting to learn, even they don't necessarily get kind of used again. Sometimes they get dumped on other countries, you know, even from that point. So this kind of whole clothing industry has become this kind of something that was intended as maybe a liberation for women to, you know, stop having to, you know, spend all their time sewing, cooking and cleaning. But now has created this other new kind of nightmare, I think. So that was all I meant.
just to pop in there, when I was, because I have a commerce degree, when I was studying and I did supply chain management, we talked about Zara and how amazing Zara was, and they could pump out clothes in something ridiculous of weeks of from design to being on the shelf. So I think that was kind of like a rejoice of like, oh yeah, we get to have all this really nice stuff really quickly. But now I think about it, maybe 2 years on from finishing my degree, I realized that those kind of systems aren't so great, and having everything at basically like a touch of a button has those really massive impacts of just the pure mass amount of clothing is just really overwhelming. And I guess for me, in my generation, it's just constantly just available to us when we're online shopping, just browsing, and things are just so cheap and so like efficient. It's just scary, and no one really stops and kind of thinks, do I really need that? Like, even I know I have a t-shirt that I bought recently that I really didn't need, but I just lied at the time. So
I think it's, sorry to butt in, I'm really pleased that you mentioned like the word efficiency. And of course, like, you know, technologically we have the capabilities to be super efficient in the way that we produce and reproduce stuff, but in the kind of economic framework that we live in, waste is built into capitalism. Like, it's an inherently wasteful system when things are made to be sold and not for use, so not for their use value, for their market value. It means that we can be as efficient as we want, you know, on a technological scale, but, you know, it's part of a broader question about how we actually move goods and why and who for.
Mm.
Great. I also wondered if you might have a comment. Ruth mentioned the idea of once upon a time women used to sew their clothes, and this mass production has liberated women. From your feminist point of view, you might have a comment there.
Oh,
you, Shannon?
To me, sorry. Yeah. absolutely. I guess it's, you know, in some ways it has liberated some women from forms of domestic labour, but really that's just been moved offshore.
Yeah.
You know, it's another example of what, like, you know, Marxists might call primitive accumulation, or, you know, not to get too technical, but it's a way of, yeah, I guess, outsourcing labour, pulling in new forms of capital to undercut, you know, the cost of producing stuff. So it actually, you know, still, even though it's free domestic labour that women kind of perform for the most part historically, it still costs a lot for our country. First world countries, so it's cheaper to
shifting that,
to monetize that and commodify it, you know, and send it somewhere else.
Shifting that domestic labor from women in Western countries to like warehouses full of women in like underdeveloped, or, you know, that's not a great word, but other countries, basically.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. What you're saying as well, Jean, which I kind of didn't really pick up on so well, is that it's also, yeah, still dominated by women, a lot of this manufacturing.
Definitely.
Just not necessarily white women.
So the idea for this discussion was art and social responsibility. I thought it might be handy to think about what is it you guys are talking about when you're thinking social responsibility. We've already talked about clothing and the manufacturing industry, but more broadly than that, perhaps.
I guess most people think of social responsibility. I think of it in terms of like individual responsibility, like what you do as an individual makes a difference, which is a theory I don't totally sit behind. just putting that out there, I think in some cases that can be really, really useful. But I was thinking about this earlier, in particular with the concept of like voting with your dollar, so buying or not buying certain products because of the ethics of the company or whatever. And thinking back to an example a few years ago now where Lynx, the deodorant company, had this like TV ad that was like this typically attractive white guy sprays Lynx on himself in, on a beach, and suddenly like literal hordes of typically attractive women come running across the beach to him. And at the same time, Dove were making this series of ads about like women and their children and like talking to your daughters before the beauty industry does, which is really great until you realize that both Lynx and Dove are owned by the same corporate multinational. So it's the same company pushing both these ideals. So I think particularly in kind of like a global capitalism in a lot of circumstances, like that individual responsibility is like a drop in the ocean sort of thing.
It doesn't work. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. This is the negativity.
But it's also, you know, fairly that kind of vote with your dollar is fairly anti-democratic. The more dollars you have, the more votes you get. So it's not, you know, I heard someone say once, it's one of those like unattributed quotes that gets trotted out all the time, but like if your kind of form of activism or whatever you're kind of doing, your movement, isn't accessible to poor people, it's not radical and it's not revolutionary. So that's kind of, you know, one of my criticisms of it. I also, I think social responsibility is like business jargon. It's a way to kind of obscure more meaningful terms like justice and accountability, which for me personally are more useful ways of theorising, you know, how we live well and how we live, you know, in a way that takes other people all around the world into account. But I did a little bit of research just before this podcast because I wasn't sure that I did fully understand social responsibility. Turns out maybe I did a little bit. You know, I was reading about in the late 90s, Nike as a brand was just getting hammered on the PR front for having, you know, slave labour, child labour, lots of that kind of stuff. And their workers abroad were kind of organising around wanting 75 cents more an hour for their work. And all of a sudden, Nike had this really good idea to have this kind of like social responsibility department where they, you know, allocated $10 million to philanthropic kind of, initiatives. And so, yeah, it cost them $10 million, but through that, they didn't have to pay 75 cents on the dollar to any of their workers, and so actually saved $200 million. Mm. So it's a really good way of winning economically and also on the PR kind of battlefield.
That's really quite interesting where that came from. Just echoing what you said about paying with your dollar and democracy, I personally think that my dollar does count. I'm just going to be the positive one on this one. maybe I think about my... I kind of see it as a kind of through like a zero waste lens. So I know that if I spend, you know, $50 on a menstrual cup, then I'm, you know, am I allowed to talk about that?
Sure.
Close your ears. Like if I spend that $50, that's going to last me years rather than continuing to have to pay and put plastic into the thing. And so like one high off, I feel like environmentally, sometimes there's high entry costs and then it kind of patters out. And what you were saying before about if it's not available to all, then is it really... What
radical or revolutionary?
Yeah, that's why that's why I kind of love clothing swaps, because sometimes I do a $5 fee and it's available to anyone. And secondhand clothing is an extremely efficient way to reuse. Mm. And it isn't going into the op shop system where you don't really know where it goes, well, most of the time. So it is really cool to see a physical exchange of things people don't need. So yeah, I was just kind of having those thoughts.
I promise I am going to be super positive later, and I do think it's really awesome that people... I just because I'm a cynic doesn't mean I don't think we should do
I'm
things.
Definitely,
absolutely.
I'm definitely a realist. I'm not a positive. Yeah. I'm not an optimistic person. I'm a realist.
I'm getting old. but... but yeah, I guess I'm really interested later for us to talk a little bit around that kind of like ways of consuming ethically, because as I thought about this and I was thinking, oh yeah, clothing swaps or dumpster diving or you know, using your car less, and I thought, man, poor people already live ethically, you know, like So, yep, but it doesn't feel 100%.
Ethical. So, 100%. The less money you have, probably the more efficient you are with the current resources that you are given. And money definitely plays a big part in how ethically you can be. Mm. So, yeah, that grinds my gears as well. Social responsibility for me is something to be tiptoed around. Definitely take it with a grain of salt. And for me, do your research, kind of read their part and then maybe read what other people are saying it. And sometimes it is just marketing at the end of the day. Mm. But yeah, that's my brief synopsis of
it. Okay, all right, there's some controversy already. all right, so art and social responsibility then. If we're thinking about art and artists and exhibitions, what is the role of art and of artists in trying to make people more socially responsible, if we go with that term, or justice, or whatever it is you want to be thinking about? But how can art play a role anyway?
I mean, I think it can. And I think the art that I really like and I'm really passionate about, it's integral to that kind of art. And it's the kind of art I want to show and make. And I think, like, I don't think you can make something that isn't political. I think everything, like, no matter what, has politics inherent to it, because that's just how we live. So I am really passionate about art that, like, this exhibition kind of comes up against those issues, and especially in public spaces like this, can kind of make people think. We had a previous exhibition on, actually the last one you guys were here for, Precarious Nature on Environmental Issues, and one of the key things I really liked about that was underneath every wall text explaining what a work was, there was an additional wall text explaining what the, like, environmental issue addressed by the work was, and also had, like, bullet points of, like, things visitors can do now to address these issues. And I think both in art making and curating, there are really key ways to, I guess, engage with the ideas of social responsibility or social justice or, like, current issues. Yeah.
So it factors into what you choose to curate?
Yeah. I don't curate at Coca currently, but in what I do curate elsewhere, that, yeah, absolutely.
As non-artists?
Yeah, it's just kind of question mark. I guess when I was learning about Ruth's work before I did the clothing swap here, it was one thing that I did get really excited about, to physically see something which is happening in our world. As a non-art person, I was like, yes, this sounds awesome. And I read this, like, blurb thing about it, and I was like, yes. But yeah, definitely, I guess art always does have... would be difficult not to be political. But I also think art also can be represented in fashion as well. I know that I wear a lot of plant-based clothing, which I kind of guess is a weird way of representing through my fashion. I'm kind of spreading a message. And when someone asks me, oh, where did you get that? I go, oh, that's secondhand. That's kind of a conversation. I know that as women, we kind of... we look at how each other look, and then we can do better with kind of describing where we get things from, and spreading, I don't know, our self-expression is really important. So I kind of think it from a fashion perspective, we can do a lot better. Does that make any sense?
Ruth, did you want to jump in here?
Yeah, why not? I'm thinking two things. One of which is about... how art can kind of mess with the languages of things. I mean, I don't know that all art necessarily, there's a one-to-one directly affects social change. I mean, I'm not saying that's impossible, because there is some art that comes kind of pretty close to it. I have an American friend who does work with kind of prisons, and by which I don't mean that he's a sort of art therapist in the prison. On the contrary, it's quite a different sort of thing. He takes the museum to the prison and the prison to the museum. It's quite disturbing stuff that he does. And it's had quite an impact on the place where he lives, raising all sorts of... opening up dialogues with people that weren't previously talking to each other and things like that. So I think it can have that. But I also think that sometimes art just changes. It's kind of can be a bit like, oh, this is going to sound really terrible and sort of vaguely academic, but kind of blue sky thinking around just how a conversation's set up or how a language of things is or your expectations maybe even about art or what's happening inside the gallery, all those kinds of things. And that's worthy work, I think. You know, that's stuff that interests me. But at the same time, the other thing I was just thinking about was it's just this constant feeling of my own kind of complicity in all these things, that these aren't just abstract critiques, you know. Maybe the main thing that's getting changed is me myself. Like, so the projects that has stopped me coming here to be with you, which I can't turn around and show you because I'm in the room next door to it. Actually, just before I went and hid the giant rubbish bin full of polystyrene, you know, so that you couldn't see it in the background of the Skype. Now, I've undertaken to do something. I feel like I've regressed since Geophagy. This particular project is just kind of grossing me out with the social implications of, or the environmental implications of all the things that I've chosen to do. And the fact that I was seen found by other people outside the studio vacuuming the asphalt, trying to sort of vacuum up every last little sort of, you know, cell of polystyrene so it didn't head off down into the gully to live there for the next million years, whereas I'm fully planning to send a whole lot of it to a landfill. I mean, it's just appalling, you know. So I've regressed already, but I don't think I'll be going here again. I've learnt my lesson sort of too well. So those are the things that I'm thinking of. I think art can have genuine direct social impact.
I really love the idea of geophagy. It reminds me of a book called 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, which is an amazing book. And there's a character in it called Rebecca, and every time she's really isolated or lonely or sad, she eats dirt and eats whitewash, and it's like a way of feeling not alienated. Mm. It feels like that kind of conversation around alienation is also relevant and applicable here. It's like, how connected do we feel to our environments and, you know, to our work and stuff like that. So I really like it, and I like the idea of this as I think either Jen or Ruth, whoever in the bit that I was reading outside put it, is this conscious and purposeful consumption, because we have to consume and we have to reproduce ourselves and our lives, but we can do it in good ways. And so I'm not an artist, an art critic or an art practitioner, but I'm kind of a little bit a writer and a reader, and the way I feel about art is the same way I feel about literature, which is that I would like to think that it can change the world, and small parts of me sort of do, and, you know, in small ways these things matter, whether it's just changing your mind or little moments of realization or conversations, but I think mostly it's just the sort of start of something else, and so it's building from there in quite a sort of organized and non-individual way that will really work for sustaining change.
Yeah, it was really interesting in researching this exhibition and the texts that had already been written about it. Almost everyone who wrote about it went straight for the geophagy, consuming the earth, destruction of the earth metaphor. But I read in it something, I guess, a little bit more positive, thinking about like Ruth's references to indigenous cultures across the earth who, for example, use balls of clay when they cook foods that are really high in toxins because the clay soaks up the toxins and makes the food able to eat. And I guess in writing about the exhibition, I kept coming back to, I guess, like indigenous knowledge and the understanding of the earth, like in Te Ao Māori, concepts like rahui, like, you know, closing off an area for various reasons, like someone's died in a lake or the kaimoana in a certain area is dying out, things like that. But also this really fantastic text by a Māori academic, Emily Rākete, who talks about the relationship between like people and nature, or Papatūānuku, and how that relationship is I guess, like one-to-one and these feedback loops and that Indigenous knowledge. And I think in writing about this exhibition, I came to think of geophagy as like kind of like the thing that will save us, like a inherent close understanding of the earth and what we're doing to it, and this complicity of destroying the thing that we need to live. And I think that comes back to that alienation, like we're all stuck in this together and no one really quite knows what to do, and it's all quite overwhelming.
Mm. Another way of reading it as well is, if we're thinking about connection, is somebody has already worn that garment and now it's having another life, however you choose to interpret that, whether that's on a stack in an art gallery or whether it's for a clothing swap or an op shop. You know, things live on. Geophagy is inside an art gallery. And Alice, you mentioned if you're thinking about art as the clothing that you choose to wear, you obviously bring that around with you. But if art is traditionally inside a building, inside a gallery, how does that impact on its ability, I suppose, to reach some of these people or get its messages out?
Yeah, I can jump back in there. I guess the immediate step for me is like public art, which is quite literally art that exists outside of a gallery and in public. And also thinking about how often some public art is like really controversial, or not necessarily public art, but like art that hits the headlines. I had a couple examples. I was thinking of the Parkin Drawing Prize, which happens every year or every second year. Which every single time it happens, it ends up in stuff because the judges are really quite open about what they accept as drawing. So the most recent prize was a bunch of carpet hanging around the gallery that was cut from the like the floor mat of a one-bedroom state house in Auckland. And all of a sudden, this kind of obscure drawing prize, which otherwise people wouldn't care about, was being debated by like my grandmother and my aunt, and like people going like, "How is that drawing? Oh, but it's really interesting." And also thinking about Michael Parakofai's state house on the Auckland waterfront, which was like really interestingly funded by Barfoot and Thompson, who are a real estate agency, and like some people love it, but I found it really interesting that a lot of people like living in state houses, and particularly Nikki Rauti, who has been constantly fighting to not be evicted from her state home, were just like, they're making fun of us. But I think art like that, art in public, that sometimes kind of baits the New Zealand media into like getting that publicity through a controversial statement, massively just widens the audience of who sees it, and all of a sudden everyone has an opinion on it, whether it like whether that opinion is related to the like concept or the politics of the work, or whether that opinion is just like, that's not art. People are still engaging with it and thinking about it, and I find that, yeah, I think that's great.
You actually also brought up another question I'm keen to talk about. You mentioned the State House on the waterfront sponsored by a real estate company, and I suppose public art in particular being sponsored by corporations. Who obviously, we've talked about Nike, for example, having a particular message. You know, you spent X amount to cover up almost certain elements that might not be so ethically sound. I think there could be a problem in that too.
Yeah, and I don't know how to feel about that.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's really complicated that Barfoot and Thompson gave like $1 million for this public artwork. But I also think, like, they didn't give that money knowing it's going to be a like model of a state house. So I think there's some credit to Michael Parakofai, the artist, in kind of thinking about what he was going to do with this money and deciding to, I guess, like, face that head on, like the housing crisis funded
did,
by.
Did they ever formally, like, did the funders ever formally, like, respond to the artwork at all? Or?
Not that I know of, no.
Mm.
Yeah.
That would have been interesting.
I think on the topic of like whether galleries are prohibitive to people at all, there are always going to be barriers to entry and participation, like might just be literacy or transport or price. There are always going to be things, and you should try to mitigate them where possible. But if you can't, it doesn't necessarily mean you shouldn't do something. It just means you have to also do other things and more things. I certainly don't want to live in a world where we don't have art, because I think that's another indication of an unhealthy society. But I guess it's just, you know, the gallery and what, and more, you know, ask for more. We only want the world.
Yeah, and sorry, Ruth, are you going to?
No, I was just enjoying We Only Want the World.
Yeah, and I think that's something that we who work here at COCA are really keen on. Like, we are very aware that we're a real traditional white wall gallery, and really aware of our history as the Canterbury Society of the Arts, whose purpose when it was founded was to bring art to the colony. And I think so much of what we do, whether it's in our the exhibitions we hold or whether it's the events we hold during those exhibitions, is trying to enable that access to our space and also kind of let people know that this is a space they can be in. Because I think, like, our space is prohibitive and, like, historically our membership and visitation have been, like, you know, typical Christchurch, the Christchurch art demographic of, you know, white people with money. So I think we're definitely really interested in breaking those boundaries down as much as we can, because if you're only reaching a very narrow audience, you know, you're not doing as much as you can.
Well, I think that might be a good place to leave it at. Ruth, have you got anything else before we head for the audience question and answer?
No, just except that, you know, following on from that, you know, I've really appreciated and enjoyed, you know, Kai and Jen have worked very hard to wrap the exhibition around with other events. So there was a clothing swap organised by a woman, Sakuru, who does basically that. She sets up kind of community clothing swaps where people can get together and exchange clothing, and that went off like a house on fire. And then just recently, more recently, a young man, Stephen Park, who makes his own, is it plant-based or is it just that it's organic kind of clothing and works out of Christchurch? So that's bringing in different people into the gallery, and I know that's something that is really important to Kai, and I've been quite keen on that happening too, because I'm sort of aware that, you know, the environment and the kind of work that it is, it needs some extension out, otherwise it just sits there like a going, oh, hey, I've got these really, you know, I think I'm talking about this, but how much of a platform does it provide for that conversation to develop or grow? And so it's been really exciting watching that. And then, you know, like this is a third version thereof. So thanks to you all kind of for that. But yeah. No, open to any questions if anyone's got them, and no drama if nobody does. They might have questions for the others.
Any final comments from you guys?
Just a final comment about Christchurch. I've just been travelling for the last month, so it's just nice to come home and just see all our art murals and kind of just art and just everywhere. Just casually, as you walk by. I think those places do have a space to really kind of voice issues and kind of like guerrilla art or just things just on the pavement that just make you think. Yeah, that's the kind of art that I mostly consume.
Yeah, I think Christchurch has such a special relationship with public art, especially when like all the galleries were closed post-quake. Like that was what it was, and it's such a unique relationship to public art, and I really love it.
I just want to finally say, do annoy people, because that is a thing that you should still do. Don't tap out, even if it feels overwhelming. Let's go for it.
Kia ora koutou. My name is Kai. I'm the curator here at COCA, and I'm jumping in because I can't help myself. It's not really a question, but I wanted to add a little bit to the agency of art within a gallery, and something that I've spent a long time thinking about as somebody who's kind of quite invested in the idea of social justice. Responsibility is another word, which I'm a little uncomfortable with. But thinking about that and why I work in a gallery space, part of it is that when people come in off the street into a gallery, on some level they're ready to have a conversation with the art. There's an unspoken kind of contract that happens where you're stepping out of what you kind of would ordinarily be encountering and stepping into an art space. And I think that gives us the potential to take more risks, to show things which people might find quite confrontational, and to show things that you can't show in a public space. Because if you put some of the things that we're able to show in the gallery in the public, there would be an outcry. So I think whilst there are many, many problems with access and accessibility in terms of a white gallery space, there is a potency in that as well that I'm really interested in exploring. And as Jen said, we do our best to program accessibility even around the really complicated shows. So I also just wanted to say thanks, Ruth. Your contribution today has been fantastic. Really appreciate you Skyping in. Kia ora.
Thank you. Just on what Kai said about there would be an outcry if we put some of the stuff out in the public that we have in the gallery space, would that be such a problem? Or is that the revolutionary and the radical that we're looking for?
Yes and no. I would love to put some of the stuff we have had here in public, but I also would really like to protect the marginalised artists that we've worked with. Like Faf Swag, who we had during Making Space, who like a queer poly fantastic collective, did some amazing stuff in here, and they put themselves in public, which is fantastic. But so much around the programming of their events was making sure that this was a space they could perform and be themselves in, and being able to, I guess, control the audience a little bit. And I'm all for pushing the boundaries in public and like causing that controversy, but I'm also quite aware of the backlash it can have on the artists involved.
You have to be like take safety quite seriously. And that's one instance where that's a good example. But also I am all for public controversy. But you know, it has to be sustainable. The spectacle is good and it can start stuff off, and it can be useful, but what do you do with that? So like, yes, let's throw stuff, but then let's talk about it afterwards.
I think there's a sweet spot between like the spectacle and the position where people come to something and are challenged but then feel that they have capacity to act. Like if you challenge somebody too much, especially in public space where they haven't entered like that sort of unspoken contract where they want to be challenged, then you run the risk of turning them off entirely, and then you get like a shutdown.
They will ignore you.
They'll ignore you. So like there's kind of, you're always negotiating these lines when you're working with anything where you're trying to create social change, I think.
So I have a question about, I guess, a different kind of art that you didn't really touch on in the discussion. And that's kind of, I guess, mainstream art, or sort of the building blocks of pop culture kind of art. So my background, just to give you some context, my background's in politics and climate change activism. So when I think about social responsibility, I usually think about environmental justice and those kind of concepts. And it seems to me that kind of mainstream, top 40 radio pop culture art has entered into political conversations at different times in ways that have been quite significant. I mean, I think of the Vietnam War, or when I was a teenager, the Iraq War in the United States. There's been different times where that has happened, but it doesn't and hasn't really entered into any kind of conversation about climate change issues or what I guess you could broadly call social responsibility. And I wonder if you think there is a space for that to happen, or whether it's just not really possible because of the way we consume that kind of artwork, or just if you have any thoughts about that kind of concept.
I mean, I think obviously what you would call like pop media or pop art, popular, you know, top 40 stuff absolutely can be political. And we're seeing that right now with like the Me Too movement that, you know, kind of picked up with Hollywood and the film industry, and it's just now shifted into the Grammys as well. And I think there are waves. I think on a large level, it's really interesting because these are all people who have accumulated masses and masses of wealth, which I fundamentally don't think is possible to do in an ethical way. In terms of climate change in particular, it's interesting that that hasn't kind of hit the top 40 stuff. I don't think there's any reason why it can't. And I'm sure there are examples here and there of individual artists, like musicians or, you know, filmmakers or stuff like that who have. Anyone want to?
Leonardo da Vinci's... Wasn't there a documentary that he did?
DiCaprio.
It's DiCaprio, yeah. This is why I don't aunt. didn't he do a popular documentary about climate change?
Yeah.
So that was... That's kind of like...
I don't know, but that is such an interesting question that I'm going to think about more and probably have something to say in like 4 or 5 hours' time. But I do kind of like the idea of really expanding what we mean by art. This is the totally weird direction I've taken your question in, which is actually thinking about stuff like when you said building blocks, I thought about like, oh yeah, like, you know, art of cities and stuff like that. So how can we kind of get outside of galleries in that way? And, you know, I would really like to see stuff around how we might live fundamentally differently, you know, in a way that was more in line with our climate and in our environment. I was thinking about, like, oh, transport. What if we didn't need to, like, drive to work because we lived by our work? Or, you know, I don't know. It could be anything. So that's kind of what you made me think about in a really weird and roundabout way.
But. And I think that's the magnitude climate change demands. Like, it's such a massive issue that affects... quite literally, like, every aspect of how we live. And I think that comes across in this exhibition. So often it's just, like, overwhelming. There's those, like, individual choices of, like, what you do and don't buy, and then there's, like, how you get around. And I think for a lot of people, either it's really, really overwhelming or they don't have the means to make some of those changes, or, like, they make some of those individual changes, but that's it. I think there's got to be some... stronger, unified, I think sadly, from like a governmental change sort of level around so many things around like power generation and transport options and stuff like that. I think climate change, when it comes to like individual social responsibility, is something that can't effectively be challenged just by individual choices.
It's interesting you say that because I would have thought that as somebody who's also not an artist, I would have thought that climate change and environment comes up actually a lot in art. Not just in sort of gallery art, but if we're expanding it further to talk about movies and things like that. I would have thought it's one of the topics, these political big question topics that people deal with the most, actually.
And maybe in quite a sort of thriller way, like maybe Ruth wants to say something here, but there's no shortage of disaster movies, that's for sure. But there isn't really anything that kind of poses something useful for us to do. You know, it's like we're going to all be wiped out by a storm or like Sharknado.
So Ruth, do you want to come in?
No, that was me chuckling again about Sharknado.
That's really
good. Oh no, I'm thinking two things. I've never been particularly good at spontaneous oral listing. It's never been one of my strengths in the world. So I can't suddenly turn myself into a, you know, art historian who can kind of, you know, list all the wonderful, you know, social responsibility art that I have seen and enjoy and appreciate for you, which is really sad, and it would be good if I could do that. It's also, I'm a little bit brain damaged from too much hard work on the current project, a little bit, but I think it is out there, and if it was Shannon who said, you know, it's right to be extended out to kind of, you know, literature and, you know, film, I mean, you know, is it Kurt Sears' Lives of the Animals is one of the, you know, a profoundly affecting kind of book that I've read in the last, you know, last while on a subject that, you know, can't help but also be of relevance at the moment on, you know, human-animal interrelations, etc. So I don't know, I haven't got any final words of wisdom or, you know, the pièce de résistance to kind of cap it off for anybody, and I think that might be kind of appropriate in a way. I think there are lots of things we can do, and I think that there is some good art that can get you involved in doing things. And if it just means that it develops, if you have a thirst for it or a hunger for it, maybe time to start making it, or, you know, also encouraging the work of that kind that you like, you know, things that will make you plant things or maybe do something differently with clothing, animals, transport, all sorts of things like that. I do think we've all got lots of opportunities, and you know, like I say, this the project I'm working on at the moment, this seems so astonishingly old school and kind of poisonous in a way that you know, I'm keen to kind of get back on the horse. So
thinking in this moment about things like the Me Too movement versus climate change, and how like the Me Too movement has cropped up not only in celebrities talking in their capacity as a celebrity, but also in their art. The cynical part of me thinks maybe these people behind the scenes are looking at what the public are talking about in social media and have decided in a very calculated move that, like, purely not separating the artist and the celebrity from the people behind them, because I think a lot of these, like, the artists and people have really good intentions here. But I think probably the reason why this has started appearing in art, because the people who are producing and releasing it have decided that it's probably commercially viable. Mm. And I think that plays an aspect to it. And I think there's something about climate change, whether it's public support and awareness or the utter grimness of like very near potential apocalypse, that makes art about it not as commercially viable. It's just the theory.
Sexy.
It's not, yeah. That's just the theory, but that's a suspicion I have.
I guess it feels like you can do more as well.
Yeah.
You know, I think people probably feel like my voice matters when I wear my pants. And I'm not saying that it doesn't. I'm just saying that, yeah, we've talked a lot about how overwhelming this, like, global kind of issue is.
I think, again, a cynical part of me thinks maybe it's a little bit adversarial as well. Like, I obviously fully support of the Me Too movement, but just thinking about what I've observed in social media and online behaviour with climate change, it's not as easy to go, that's the bad guy. They've got to change. Because we're all complicit. And, like, we are all complicit in abuse, but that's not the mainstream narrative. It's, like, the bad guys and us. And that doesn't exist in climate change, and I think that might feed into it as well.
Any final questions from you guys? Okay, well, I'd like to say thank you so much to our panelists, Ruth, Alice, Shannon, and Jen. It's been a wide-ranging discussion. I hadn't necessarily expected we'd end up on climate change, but that's great. And hopefully you guys got a lot out of it as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kia ora.
Hey.